Hello, welcome to the City of Charles Sturt's pod tour of Brompton. It's called Digging Up the Dirt, because that's what we're going to be doing. I'm Grant Cameron from 891 ABC Adelaide, and I'm your guide. We'll start our walk at Josiah Mitten Reserve, then we'll loop and meander through the streets of Brompton until we come to an end at the Excelsior Hotel. Now, this is going to take us about an hour and a half to do this tour at a fairly leisurely pace. We'll be covering close to 3.5 kilometres, so if you're concerned that it might be too far, I'd encourage you to think about taking the tour in stages. Whenever you feel the need, just put this player on pause, give yourself some time out for a breather and a drink and maybe a snack as well, and a chance to take in where you are and what you've seen so far. I should also point out that this tour features an optional detour past the Brompton School. That's going to add an extra kilometre to the journey, and if you have the time and the energy, I'd certainly recommend it. But if you don't, file it away for another day. I'll let you know when we get to that detour point. This walk has been developed in partnership with 891 ABC Adelaide, St Anna's Hostel, the Hindmarsh Historical Society, Bowden Brompton Community Centre and Hindmarsh Greening. Before we set out, can I quickly remind you to take care when you're walking. Now, some of the footpaths you'll be using are narrow and a bit uneven, especially on Hocking Street and West Street, which are a couple of the oldest in the area. And while I know that you'll become immersed in the stories and the history as we continue digging up the dirt, can I also ask that you at least keep half an ear tuned for cars and other traffic? We want this pod tour to be as safe as it will be enjoyable and memorable. Brompton has a colourful and fascinating history, with stories almost every step of the way. And as we wander and ponder, you'll hear some of the stories from the people who have, and still, call Brompton home. Brompton was laid out in 1840 as part of the town of Hindmarsh, and since then, it's enjoyed a series of popularity peaks and troughs. Brompton was once considered to be a slum. At one stage, it was littered with brick kilns and pockmarked with pug holes that produced the raw material. And now, you find modern housing estates and very desirable dwellings. Hopefully, you've downloaded the map that came with the pod tour on the City of Charles Sturt website. But if you haven't, fear not, you'll find a map on the walk brochure at the Hindmarsh Library on Port Road. Failing that, just listen carefully. I'll give you the directions you need to do the loop without getting lost. Okay, let's hit the trail and start digging up the dirt. First stop, Josiah Mitten Reserve. We get there from Wood Avenue, Hawker Street, or Burley Griffin Boulevard.
Stop 1, Josiah Mitten Reserve.
Brompton is built on brickyards in more ways than one. Backyard brickmaking enterprises started to appear not long after Brompton was laid out. And for more than a century, brick and pottery making was a key industry in this area, employing many of the local residents. At one point, there were close to 100 brickyards in Brompton, and the landscape became pockmarked with pug holes, the deep pits from which the clay was dug. This reserve was once a large pug hole. It stretched from Hawker Street across this site to Coghlan Street, and it would have been 8 to 10 metres deep. As you can imagine, brickmaking was hard work, hot in summer and cold and wet in winter. The clay, or pug, was dug by hand. Brickmaking certainly not a job for the weak or faint-hearted. Early on, families worked their own blocks, digging the clay by hand, but mixing it with their bare feet. Bricks were hand-shaped in wooden moulds, stacked to dry, and then covered with wood for firing. And quality control was a bit of a hit-and-miss affair. In the 1870s, a building boom and the introduction of the brick kiln saw many of these family-run enterprises absorbed by the expanding larger yards. While horse and steam-powered machines began to be used during the brickmaking process, much of the work was still done by hand. The use of kilns produced a better quality product, but keeping the fire heat constant was a very demanding job. The men responsible for feeding those fires worked outside in all kinds of weather, most of the time bent over double, pushing wood into the ground-level small holes of the fireboxes. Even in the 1960s, ensuring that the bricks were fired correctly was a long and tiring process. Sometimes it would take one team 20 hours to get the job done, and they were not paid overtime. This work was a lifelong job. Many started straight from school as young lads of 13 or 14. Max Hammonds started work in a local pottery yard in 1940.
All I wanted to do was get out of school and work. I didn't like school. The only part I liked school was playing the sport, cricket or football or something like that. My dad had known for a while I wanted to get away from school. And Dad said, what are you going to do now? Are you going to go to work or are you going to go to school again? I said, no, don't want to go to school. said, right. He said, I'll see if I can get a job for you. So he only asked one of the chaps that lived around the area, any chance of a job at the Pottery's? So I'll find out, yeah, no worries. Went up there and started straight away. When you first started there, you used to only help out in the kills, help the men take little things or anything, small things you could carry into the kill so they could set it. And they burnt the kill after then. But you'd start off on that. Then if they thought you could do another job, they'd try and take you right through. Then they might put you on what we used to call junction sticking. You stick two pipes together, different angles and all that. Squares and OBs and all that, we used to call them, like that, for the sewage drains. Well, then, after that, if you went all right at that, you'd go to moulding. Anything you moulded by hand, well, you had to make them. And, well, that was interesting too. When you was moulding and all that, well, they'd mix the red clay they got from down the Pogo there. And they also brought in white clay from Golden Grove in those days. They used to have a pit up there. And they'd bring it down where they'd mix it together. Well, that was all right. But through winter, all your hands used to crack and all through, going through water and clay all the time. Oh, yeah. They used to get sore. But, no, she was all right. I don't know how anyone could grizzle, you know, in a job like that. There was a lot of hard work in that. I reckon the ones down the Pug Hole did, yes. But I only went down there one day. There was one chap missing, so they sent me down there. I wasn't too impressed with that. That was hard work. You had to pick and shovel and that. You had to pick the clay down off the bank, the side of the bank, say a wall. You had to pick it down and dig it all up and put it in this truck and then push the truck right back underneath to the sheds. And they had lifts from where I said about the tunnels. There's lifts going from there up to the shed, and they'd tip the truck up there and then bring it down and go out again. That's hard work. But a lot of them did it, mostly, when we were there, mostly the older men were out there that were doing that, been doing it for years.
And while the adults slaved away, digging the clay and making the bricks, the local children, even though their parents gave them strict orders not to go there, found the Pug Hole an adventurous and exciting place to play.
Oh, in those days, you used to go down the Pug Hole there because they had railway tracks down there for little trucks that had to come down to take the clay back to in the sheds and that. Well, sometimes they'd leave one of them out over the weekend, of course. Us kids would get down there and roll it up and down, push it up and down the track all the time there. Yeah, we used to do a lot of things down there. Used to go bird nesting down there, climb up the bank there. You used to have an old ladder or something, climb up the bank there and get the eggs out of the nest and everything for the birds. Yeah. Oh, then we had a swimming pool down. We used to call it a swimming pool. It was all covered with reeds around the outside with a border in the middle. And we used to get in there at different times and have a bit of a swim around. It was only about 6 foot square. It was only a small little place. But we used to get in there and have a good time in the water there. We used to have a bit of fun down there. Used to get down there at times and we'd have a little humpy we'd make down there. And we'd take a few eggs or something down and cook a few eggs in the humpy, you know, or potatoes and peel the potatoes and we'll throw them in the fire. Or, yeah. Yes. And the greengrocer around in Green Street, old Mr. Streets.
Oh, yeah.
He used to have his horses down there. And in those days, that's through winter and that, he used to have his horse trough and everything on one of the fences just wired up there. And when it rained through winter, we'd have a pool of water everywhere there. We'd go and undo the wire from the horse trough and put it down there and get a bit of a stick and make it, we were rowing around in the water. They come from everywhere, high marsh and all, you know, all around there. Used to have our fights and all down there too. Oh yeah, bricks and that, oh yeah. You'd just stand up at the top there, they'd be down the bottom or something, you'd be, oh yeah. Yeah, sometimes you hear them, sometimes you brick fights and all that, and then they'd have, some of them would have bows and arrows, or someone that might have a little bit of money, they'd come down with a slug gun. But everything was all right. No one ever got, you know, really hurt there.
Stop two, the Burley Griffin Incinerator.
We find the Burley Griffin Incinerator on Burley Griffin Boulevard on the eastern side of Josiah Mitten Reserve. You can't miss it. See that large brick structure over there on the edge of the park? That's it. The 1930s Depression forced the closure of many of the brickyards, so what to do with all the abandoned punk holes? That became the pressing issue. For Hindmarsh Council and many of the local industries, they were a rubbish disposal opportunity, and the punk holes began to be filled with all kinds of rubbish, including the still smouldering rubble of a famous city department store that was destroyed by fire. The fumes from this hung over Brompton for months. Other items allegedly dumped in local pug holes included a bus and leftover ammunition from World War II. Roy and Ron remember the stench of burning pug hole rubbish.
One of them did go over about 6 months, yeah. And it smelled like when you fry onions and you fry them too much and they're sort of half burnt. It's a horrible smell. And we live not far from there. You smell this horrible smell for about 6 months, day and night.
In 1935, as part of a relief scheme to provide work for the unemployed, construction of this Walter Burley Griffin-designed incinerator was started. It was built into the side of the pug hole, and you can still get an idea of this if you look at the incinerator from the park. Now, we all associate Walter Burley Griffin with the design of Canberra, but in the 1920s and 30s, he joined forces with another architect, Eric Nichols, to design a series of incinerators for local governments right across Australia. Burley Griffin believed in the aesthetic potential of industrial buildings and he used materials that related each building to its site, which you can see here in this incinerator through the use of bricks. As you can see, it doesn't particularly look like an incinerator, and no doubt this contributed to the rumours that the incinerator was a crematorium used for the disposing of bodies. Griffin and Nichols promoted their incinerators as efficient and hygienic, with less handling of unincinerated rubbish than any other methods. Trucks would drive up to the roller door on the top platform. They would tip their load into the garbage hopper. The rubbish was burnt as it moved down through the incinerator, and then it filled the punk hole below. This incinerator is now a Brompton icon, and it's truly significant because it's one of the few Burley Griffin-designed structures still standing in Australia. Our next stop is St Anna's Hostel. To get there, we follow Burley Griffin Boulevard to the south, passing Penn's Close on our right. The hostel is around the bend at number 41.
Stop 3, St Anna's Hostel.
St Anna's is one of the many aged care facilities that have brought new residents to Brompton, but also provided the older Bromptonites with the option to remain living in the community that they know and love. Fred McGuinness is a classic example. Fred grew up in Brompton, and before he came to St Anna's, he lived in a cottage built by his grandfather, and we'll visit that later on. St Anna's is very proud to be part of Brompton, and through its lifestyle program, it keeps residents connected to the area and its history.
With our lifestyle program, residents go for a walk around the area. And then we thought about, because also some of the residents who do go for the walks have got some degrees of dementia, that also finding something to spark off their memories and to talk about different things that happened in their childhood. Whereas this has been a very old area, and with all the new housing, some of them have got memories of what it used to be like before. So that's why we made an approach to the council to talk about a history walk so that we could actually capture things. And even though it may be the same walk that people go on continuously, it still will stir up memories within their memory bank from way back in childhood and different issues, especially when there was the pug holes and...
Because the residents know that this was a pug hole, so they make up stories about what's buried in this underneath us.
Oh, they think there could be bodies treasures,
everything, money, oh, lots of things like that. Lots of things.
We have a problem with the roses in the front garden because it obviously is where there's an old oil pit or whatever. And what has happened, especially with our dark roses, they have this dark centre part, which is obviously the roots have gone down to where the old oil pit is, and it's come up through the roses as well too.
Our next stop, the corner of Coghlan and Second Streets. To get there, we just continue along Burley Griffin Boulevard to Wood Avenue. At Wood Avenue, we turn left, and then at the next corner, we turn left again. That gets us to Second Street. On Second Street, we walk all the way to the end of the block, and that gets us to Coghlan Street. As we head towards Second Street, you might be thinking to yourself, where are all the historic buildings? Well, apart from the punk holes being redeveloped, Many of the older homes were knocked down in the 1960s to make way for a proposed freeway system across Adelaide. This was known as the Matts Plan. If it had gone ahead, it would have practically destroyed Brompton and neighbouring Bowden, because these two suburbs fell in the direct path of a north-south expressway corridor. The state government purchased many houses in preparation for this, and the inner west slid into a serious decline. Buildings were allowed to become run down, in some cases, totally uninhabitable. As you'd imagine, property values plummeted, the population fell, the community disintegrated, and people moved to wherever they could to find another home. In 1970, the Matts Plan was suspended and finally abandoned in 1983. But for all that time, Brompton just sat and stagnated. And it wasn't until the late 80s that the land created by this and the disused pug holes was seen as a development opportunity.
Stop 4. Coghlan Street.
Coghlan Street is named after Patrick Coghlan, the so-called King of Brompton Park, a former politician and a mayor of Hindmarsh. Coghlan was a pretty colourful character and well known for his wealth and the assumption of power which he felt that wealth entitled him to. He owned and subdivided this section of Brompton into very small blocks, which created very cramped living conditions. At one council meeting, it was suggested that Coghlan should be ashamed to sell people such small allotments. Coghlan interjected, "Ashamed of it? I'm ashamed of them not buying larger allotments." He was also described as being like a greyhound after a goose, in the way that he chased anyone who dared cross his land. No doubt, Coghlan's subdivision also contributed to the perception of Brompton being a slum. On these small blocks, substandard cottages were built to house workers who were desperate for cheap accommodation close to their employment. In winter, the area often flooded, and the floodwaters, combined with refuse, night soil and effluents from drains, turned the small yards into filthy patches of sodden earth. Now, we cross over Coghlan Street and keep walking along 2nd Avenue and turn right into Taylor Street.
Stop 5. Brompton Park Streets.
Life in Brompton's worker streets, like this one and neighbouring Pickering Street, was often a struggle, especially during times of unemployment such as the Depression. For women in particular, life was extremely hard. Many of them had large families, and caring for the children and doing the housework completely occupied their time and their minds. Of course, poverty would have excluded many of the women from the luxury of having their children born in a hospital. People who grew up in this part of town were aware that others regarded them as being poor. They, however, rarely thought of themselves as poor. Sure, things were tough, but they knew how to get by. They were a different type of people.
Oh, no, it was the type of people. Yeah.
I think what was, the people in the area were very poor, so it was the support that everybody was looked after one another. You with me?
Yeah.
Like, my mum was the eldest of 13 children, okay? They probably had 6 different houses or more because, you know, a lot of times at midnight they were moving because they hadn't paid their rent, so they were moving, so people looked after them, and, you know, especially with families that size. Pickering Street, for a start, and if you know the length of Pickering Street, was called Incubator Avenue because there were so many kids there. They didn't think they could breed like that. They'd have to come out the incubator. You know, there was just kids everywhere. The people really cared for one another, you know.
Well, they were all in the same position,
yeah,
to a great extent. A lot of them had the same experiences, and they could sympathise with someone new in that experience. Yeah.
And if you know the size of them homes, you can just imagine having 13 children and mum and dad, it's 15 beds they needed to find. I mean, fair enough, you know, the older ones might have been 20 or 30. Some of them might have drifted away. Not saying they're all under the same roof at the same time, but they were still backwards and forwards, you know, like, and there was a lot of grandkids.
Now we continue to walk along Taylor Street, and at the end of that, we turn left. This gets us to First Street. Fred McGuinness, who we met at St Anna's Hostel, used to live at number 12.
Stop 6. Fred's house.
This house was built by Fred McGuinness's grandfather. He came to Australia from Sweden and worked at the gasworks, which was located just down the end of the street. As one of 8 children, Fred's family was fairly typical of the area. It was large, was working class, and Fred's brother Max also lived in this house.
Well, there was 12 children my grandfather had and grandmother, so they lived in there. And there was 11 of us when we moved in. There was mum and father, 8 children, and my mother's sister lived with us. And I often think now, where'd we live? There was only really three bedrooms, plus the sleep out. And in the sleep out, there was Fred and myself, we was down one end, and two sisters were down the other end. It was very small inside, cramped. Mum always cooked on the wood stove. It was only in later years that when Fred went to the gasworks that he got a gas stove, but she always cooked on a wood stove. She was a very good cook. But I remember when I started on West Street and Hawker Street, it was Whitwell McCartney's. And that's where I started work there as apprentice cabinet maker. And I remember I used to bring the offcuts home in a bag on my bike for my mother, yeah, to burn in the stove. Whichever way the wind's blowing, you could smell the kills being burnt. Yeah. Mondays, my mother, she'd go out and look at the wind, because behind us was Worthley's, because the wind, she wouldn't wash, because you'd get that fine soot. Yeah. She always went which way the wind was blowing before she'd done her washing. Yeah. And she'd get really wild if she couldn't wash on Monday. But her washing was old wood copper, I can remember that, as you boil all the clothes. There was a big wooden mangle there, they'd put it through, all by hand, and iron. And actually, Mum's two sister, they lived in Second Street. And I always remember them, I think it was Tuesdays, the two of them would come down with the clothes to put through Mum's mangle. It was like rollers, wooden rollers. Oh, they worked hard.
Across the road from Fred's house is the MERS Housing Co-op. There are several housing cooperatives in this area, and this one is for artists. On the corner of First and Pickering Streets, we find the Brompton